where is my clubhouse?
How long do I have to answer this? If I start with, for my life, I've had a bit of trauma when I was young. I don't think the family would have got through it if it weren't for the clubhouse.
And then these people act as like the scaffolding of security. We all do act as that for each other, I hope.
The clubhouse is just the environment, not necessarily a place.
What's lovely about that little WhatsApp group is that we can share, you know, stories, we can share things that make us laugh, you know, frustrations.
It's like being around people that are going through similar things or that just understand and are just there as like a bit of a shoulder to cry on or someone to like pick you up.
Like my family, the people who support me, my wife and my twin daughters. Like my wife's unbelievable for me.
Hello and welcome to the Where's Your Clubhouse podcast, brought to you by Speakeasy Club. Now, my name's Simon Clark. I'm founder of Speakeasy and also host for this very first series, and I am super excited. Now, the Where's Your Clubhouse podcast, we sit down with some incredible people, predominantly involved in the world of sport. We talk through their life stories, really. We talk about the good, the bad and the ugly. And we ask everybody that one question. Where's your clubhouse? Where's that one place for you that you can be the best version of you? You can not feel judged. You can just feel happy and you have a bloody good time whilst doing it. It's incredible to hear some of the responses, and it's a question I don't think we really spend a lot of time asking ourselves, really. So I can't wait to share some of the responses. Now, we couldn't be here without a brilliant, brilliant partner in Mentality Clothing. I'm so excited to join up with two young lads who are sharing a passion, creating a community, investing finances back into a brilliant charity in Mind Cymru. But they developed this incredible clothing line, which is cool, it's fun, it's accessible. They do big sizes for big chaps like myself. And they are just two really, really good guys trying to give back to the community. So we're delighted to offer Speakeasy 15% off. Check out their website, www.mentalityclothing.co.uk. Honestly, there's some really cool stuff on there, so please do check it out. Now, before I get into it, please, it's so important that we get your feedback on these things. Who do you want to see? How do these conversations go? Is there anything that lands with you guys? That's where we want to be, and try and pull out some of the tricky stuff as well. And hopefully there's some really relatable bits in there too. We'd love to hear from you. Please leave a review. Please leave a comment. Please share it with your friends and family. And we'd love to hear your feedback. You can follow us on all good social media platforms and some rubbish ones at Speakeasy Club 1. Now, let's get into the latest episode. Without further ado, sit back, relax, and let's find out where's your clubhouse. Nathan Horrocks, thank you so much for your time. Really, really good to see you, mate. Really appreciate you giving up. Well, I was going to say giving up a few hours of your evening, but as we'll get on to discuss, it's our evening. You're over in the States, so it's certainly not evening for you yet.
It's not. It's still the morning. We're still in the AM at the moment here, Simon. It's 11:25 here in the state of California. So it's we're still in the AM at the moment. But no, it's always a pleasure to to give my time to to what you're doing. And we were chatting about this earlier before we before we started this podcast. It's been great, the community that you're building with the Speakeasy Club, and I love what you're doing with getting people talking and around the table, which is what we're trying to do, really, is raise this awareness of communicating and sharing each other's stories.
Oh, mate, absolutely. Thank you for that. Really appreciate that. And that's, again, one of the reasons we want to reach out to you. So We've got loads of stuff we're going to chat about. There's loads of really fascinating things. We've kind of known each other for a few years now, so there's some really good background stuff I'd love to share with everybody that will listen to this. But before we get into too much of it, just take us all the way back to the beginning. Where did it all start for you, and what was it like growing up?
I mean, just recently I've been doing a lot of reflecting because unfortunately, my father passed away just before Christmas, and, so I've been having to go through like all this kind of like cathartic looking at photographs and, processing the journey I've had to like where I am right now. Cause, we just mentioned there that I live in California here and, somebody growing up in how I see it in North Yorkshire in a council estate. I often say to myself, how the hell did I get here? It just seems crazy. I pinch myself all the time that I've managed to have that journey to get here. But going back to your question, I started out in life born in Yorkshire, but was immediately moved to Kenya, because my father was a flat jockey and, moving over there and living there for 5-6 years in my early life was a great experience, really. It's a shame I can't really remember it, but all the stories that my dad shared with me, I still have, and I still tell those stories of, having to put like a wire around the garden and stop the giraffes coming in eating the roses. I mean, it just sounds crazy, right? And baboons coming on the veranda trying to drink his Optrex eye lotion and things like that. So, not having a full memory of it, but pictures that have kind of been put in my mind from my father have been enjoyable. But I suppose life really began when I moved back to the UK and moved to Middleham, North Yorkshire, which is kind of like where I say I'm from, even though I say I grew up in Africa. And that being a horse racing town, which is the world I am very much immersed in and love and very passionate about. Growing up there was great because it's one of those little villages that many people have grown up in where it's there's not a lot going on, but it's a very safe place to live. But within that, I think sometimes you can be you feel as though that if you feel a little bit different because everyone else is kind of conforming to be the same, if you're a little bit different, which I was, creative and didn't even know what creative was at that time, but thinking differently and wanting to kind of stretch myself in some way, you were seen as different and a bit odd. So I never felt as though I really fitted in that small village environment. So hence the reason why I, still love traveling right. as much. But I needed to get out of there, and I think a lot of people can kind of resonate with that of living in a small town and wanting to, and there's been many a song written about it, living in a small town and wanting to get out of it, So, that was the key for me. But what was great about growing up there was being and installing that love of horse racing, really. I think that's one thing that's taken me on this journey and continues to take me on this fabulous journey that I'm on.
So how old were you then when you first you entered the equine world, if you will? You mentioned there about very much a big part of your life now, and it was very much a huge part of Midland when you moved there. So how old were you? Take us back to that first experience.
Yeah, I mean, the first kind of experience I remember, because I was not into horse racing at all when I was a kid. I kind of thought it was for old, rich people, basically. I wasn't going to come into this sport at all. It didn't really connect with me. I was into, skating and, the counterculture stuff, really. My next door neighbour would constantly be giving me his skateboarder magazines. We couldn't afford them. So I would get all the hand-me-downs, not also hand-me-downs of his magazines, but, school clothes and things like that. So I'd be, embarrassed turning up at the school with with a pair of trousers that he'd worn and things like that, and got a little bit of the stick, for wearing clothes, for hand me down from my neighbour. But that side of the world I was kind of really attracted to, the counterculture thing of the aesthetic of skating, surfing, snowboarding, breakdancing, all that sort of stuff. Whereas horse racing hasn't got any of that. It's kind of old boys club, kind of, you know, very right, you know, very elitist. And it didn't really stand out to me. So my dad, you know, who was still, had stopped being a jockey by then, would take me to eat what we call evening stables, which is where stable hands would go down in the evening and feed the horses and, you know, dress them over, get the, you know, the mud off them if they'd been out exercising in the morning, the sweat and all that sort of stuff. So, and making sure they were taken care of, you know, for their, before they get down to sleep. But he would often try and drag me down, and I was kind of like not into it, and I didn't want to go. But there was a moment, and it was 1991, I was 16, and my dad said, come down and watch this horse run. It was NBC were doing a coverage of the, Channel 4 Racing at the time, I should say, had the NBC feed from the Breeders' Cup from 1991, and there was a horse called Arazi, which many listeners may know or may not know, but definitely go and watch this on YouTube. There's a race from the Breeders' Cup from Churchill Downs. Arazi was this super horse that was coming from Europe to take on the Americans. And he was a two-year-old, and he ran in the Breeders' Cup juvenile race. And it was like a light switch going off in me, because I was watching, you know, I've seen my dad watching racing loads of times, and he'd be getting excited, you know, shouting one home and all that sort of stuff. But this was one of those moments where, you know, I'm watching this race, and it was with the NBC feed, you know, the American razzmatazz of how the callers, you know, call a race. And also what the horse did, he was kind of weaving through. It was like watching a movie. I was like, wow, you know, it really kind of captured my imagination and made me fall in love with the sport, because it wasn't what I was used to seeing. It was the American side of how they, you know, show sport. So that really kind of ignited something in me to be more interested and more intrigued. So then I started to talk to my dad about, like, where's the horse from and why do they race like that in America on dirt and not turf and all that sort of stuff. So all of a sudden I was interested then. And then I would go to evening stables with him and immediately fell in love with why we're all in the sport is because of the horse. You know, yes, I could hear all these posh people and, you know, people that didn't look like me or sound like me on TV. But and then I realized, all right, that's why we're all in it. It's because of the, you know, because of the thoroughbred. And then when I got that connection, that was when, you know, I understood, you know, the actual essence of what this sport is about, really, and what most sports is about. You know, it's the passion of, you know, competing and having an understanding of that, really.
Just listening to you there, I find it fascinating that you couldn't find that razzmatazz in Midland, North Yorkshire. But maybe that's a conversation for a different podcast. There's so much there. Those formative years at 16, that's a really, it is an influential time of your life, I guess. And if you've kind of been brought up in it, to have this moment that you feel, and you mentioned the word there, connected to, and you felt this huge kind of, oh, so this is what it's all about. There's a few other bits I want to chat about later on, but just tell us about that. What was the next step for you then? How did you then kind of take that feeling of watching that particular Breeders' Cup race and going, I want to get involved in this now?
Well, that was the key thing, really, you know, because I wasn't sure. I just left school and I wasn't sure what I was going to do. You know, I was thinking, right, you know, I remember my dad saying, like, you're going to have to get a job now. You know, you've left school, you know, with zero qualifications. I mean, later on in life, I find out that I'm massively dyslexic. So it made sense, like, why I couldn't do very well at school. You know, I couldn't understand it, and I didn't understand the structure. And it frustrated me, this school, although I enjoyed it because I love being around people. You know, I loved school itself, but I just didn't like the structure of it, if that made sense. So, you know, I said to my dad, like, how do I get into this? So, you know, I went down to one of the local stables where a friend of mine from school had already, he was going into racing anyway. He already understood it all and had a flair for it. And I did the same thing, knocked on the, you know, the trainer's door and said, oh, can I have a job, please? And, you know, the following Saturday I'd started and never even sat on a horse, you know. So I then all of a sudden was in it, and then, you know, was immediately, like, you know, knocked over by, like, the how hard work it is to physically do this stuff, and not just the learning to ride, but the early mornings in all weathers, the mucking horses out and all that sort of stuff, you know, the real like kind of hard work that goes into to doing this job, you know. So I loved it, you know, I really enjoyed it. And what was lovely about it was I felt a sense of camaraderie with the guys and girls that I was kind of working with. Although they could be quite sharp with you, and if you weren't kind of grasping it early on, you know you got to kick it. I'm sure it's the same in a factory, or it's the same in the military, you know, if you're not getting switched on pretty quickly, they'll teach you, but you got to like grasp it pretty quick. You could you know, be you know, taken aside and told, you know, you're getting this all wrong, you know. But I enjoyed that side of the community and all sense of being a part of one thing, really. So I found it hard, but I really enjoyed it and started to progress that way, really.
I want to unpick that culture piece a little bit more, because I find it fascinating that, as you say, it's early mornings, it's high pressure, you're dealing with these animals that, not wishing to be crass or anything, but people have paid a lot of money for and entrusted you and the team at the yard to kind of not only just look after them, of course, but to make them successful. What is that culture like? Is it supportive as well as sharp, as you say, to play that word back to you? Is there just this feeling of, look, we're all in this together, or can it be quite challenging at times?
Well, no, I agree with you. And it's something you kind of don't really understand till kind of late on, because you understand that there's, you know, people own these horses, but you're given a horse to look after, or three or four horses to look after. I mean, the structure's changed a little bit to when I first started, but it's still the same. You know, the horses that are under that trainer's name, they're all part of under your care. And, you know, it takes you a while to understand like what that responsibility means. Because at the time you're thinking, oh yeah, I'm just working here. But no, they're in your care. It's like, you know, I understand it now. Now I'm married to a teacher, like what it's like for her, you know, when all these kids get sent to her school and they're all under her care, you know. So I understand that, of that responsibility now. But I never really understood it properly when I was first started in the sport. It took me a while to understand that. But, you know, that sense of community was great, and because they would understand it, because they'd been there a while. You know, the other members of staff would often say to me, you know, you've got to make sure that, you know, certain things are done, or else this could happen or that could happen. Because like you say, we're working with animals and they're very unpredictable anyway. You know, they're flight animals. And we're trying to make sure that they stay as safe as possible, and they get to the race course in a safe manner to do the job that they've been bred to do, which is to, you know, run in races for their owner and for their trainer and the jockey. So it was an exciting but also kind of like daunting start to my journey in the sport.
Absolutely. Oh, I can only imagine. Was there you're in that world, and as you say, early mornings, and you're looking after this incredibly prized possession to many people in many different ways. What, do you remember that moment where you thought, I feel like jockey's the way forward. I feel like that's where I want to be. And was there a particular time, or did you almost just fall into it?
I think I was always wanting, because my dad was a jockey, I was immediately that's what I wanted to do. And that's the quick way to, you know, because we're all the same, aren't we? You know, that's the quick way to fame. That's how we see, you know, ourselves. We want to be known, we want to be loved, we want to be, you know, appreciated in some way. We all have that inside us. Now then, you know, I wanted to be a jockey from the very, very start, because that was the exciting part of it, you know, riding in a race, and especially when I first sat on a thoroughbred and I would be thrown off every 2 seconds, you know, learning to ride in this field with, you know, with a couple of the stable, stables members of staff teaching me how to ride. But once I was getting back on and starting to enjoy it and understanding what the process it takes to ride a horse, then I wanted to do it in a professional level, which was, you know, moving into being a jockey. And, you know, I did that at, you know, it took me a few years to get in, you know, to get to that point. Some guys start at, you know, starting racing at 16, but they've been riding ponies since they were, you know, since they were children. But I didn't start riding till I was 16. So it took me 2 or 3 years before I got my first ride. So I was very lucky to, you know, I got my first ride when I was around 19. And, you know, that feeling of riding your first race, it's, I think it's, you know, pardon me being crass, but it's a bit like the first time you have sex, you know, it's like, you've got no idea, like, what the hell just happened there? You know, it's such a, you know, crazy sensation. You can't even remember what actually happened. You know what I mean? It was like, what the hell happened there? You know, because it just can't, you can't take it all in at the time. And then, you know, I was very lucky enough to actually rode a winner on my second ride, which I was very lucky to do. And it's the only thing my dad ever had one up on me, because he rode a winner on his first ride. I had rode a winner on my second ride. So he's always been, always had a dig at me for that. But he's definitely never let me forget that. No. And I think the excitement of that and the thrill of that and the enjoyment I got out of that just was, you know, like, oh my God, yeah, this is a drug, you know, that excitement of riding a race, but actually physically winning a race, you're like, wow, this is powerful stuff, you know? And, that's when I wanted to, you know, really kind of, embrace that and chase that dream really of trying to be a successful professional jockey.
So just talk us through, what is the life of a professional jockey? The layperson will see it, will watch on telly, will looks all glitz and glamour and looks really, really kind of exciting and relatively easy. But from my very limited knowledge, it probably is a lot further away from the truth. So just walk us through what that life is like and maybe some of the realities that the non-racing fan may not be aware of.
Well, I think that's what I'm constantly chasing, really, Simon. Even what I'm doing today is like, how do I communicate the life of what it's like of being a jockey? You know, my wife is not from horse racing. I met her in a bar in Louisville, Kentucky. You know, she's a school teacher. She has absolutely no idea about this sport, you know, and, you know, trying to, you know, when I was explaining to her the same thing, she was like, you know, what's that life like? And it's kind of hard to explain in a sentence, but basically what we're constantly trying to do is, you know, we're always wanting to get on the next best horse or ride the winner in the next race. Now, jockeys, unlike other sports people, run at a very low percentage rate, you know, so a very good jockey would have a, you know, a 10 to 15% strike rate. Now imagine your premiership football team or your rugby team or your cricket team had that same strike rate percentage. They would be awful at what they do. It's just because the amount of race riding that jockeys do, you know, there's constantly race riding, you know, to get on more horses and ride winners. But it can be very grueling, the life of a jockey. Not only are you traveling around the country, and this is just, you know, I'm using the UK as an example, you know, traveling, you know, around the country to, you know, to riding races, you're dieting all the time and you're constantly for sale. So you can never burn any bridges, you know? So if you disagree with an owner or a trainer, you can't really put your head on the line because you want to make sure that you're going to get the ride on another horse or on that horse again going forward. So you're constantly kind of under the microscope, and that's the only way I can describe what it's like to be a jockey, is like you're constantly under the microscope and you're constantly for sale. You are a contractor. You're not a part of a team. You're on your own. You are a freelancer. And that's what makes it kind of really difficult when it comes to, being supported is, you feel alone a lot of the time, really. The only time you don't feel alone, and that's what's lovely about this sport, is when you're in the changing room with the other guys that are trying to pinch your rides that want the same thing that you do, right? But you don't feel alone there because there's a sense of camaraderie, really. So it's a weird thing to try and describe till you've actually been in it. And I've tried to do it in many things. You know, you will come on to it later. You know, the reason why I'm doing what I'm doing now is, you know, I want to be a storyteller of how to convey this sport and get people to love it. And the same thing with Jockey Cam, having people understand it from that perspective, because we can do that with other sports. And that's what we've been trying to do here. But that's always been my goal, is to show the difficulties, because once you have an appreciation of how difficult this sport can be, then you can understand like why people do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've mentioned already about that connection and people wanting to have connection with that thing and its horses in this case. And you've mentioned a few things there I definitely want to pick up in a moment. How long were you a jockey for in the end? How long were
just over 10 years. Yeah, just over 10 years.
Wow.
And I'll be honest with you, you know, it was... I wasn't a successful jockey in by the you know by any shape of imagination. But what I did do was you know I was able to with the tools that I was given I did well with them. I enjoyed getting horses to win that other people couldn't win with. You know what I mean? I was a different kind of. I saw myself as a different kind of ride. It wasn't all power. I was more finesse. You know, so right. There's a different way of riding. You know, it's not. It isn't all about strength. It can be finesse as well. Although strength does come into it. You know, there's lots of many facets of what makes a jockey different to another jockey. But that's the way I kind of was able to succeed was winning on horses that other people hadn't won on. You know, the horse had probably had enough of racing, because you know they're like people, horses. You know, some are lazy, some are nervous, some aren't very nice like people, you know. And it's working out like, how do I get the best out of you? And that's what the bit I enjoyed was working out how do I get to you, you know, how do I work out who you are and get the best out of you to achieve something for the owner or the trainer that I'm riding for.
Did you find that certain owners or certain trainers kind of responded to that more than others? Is that a particular mindset that links with trainers or owners in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, I just touching on it there, you know, it's you're constantly for sale, so you're wanting to make sure that you're going to be hired again. You know, it's like you're painting the house, you want to make sure, you know, I've done a good job here. You're going to hire me to paint that next house. Do you know what I mean? Or you're going to hire me to, you know, serve you that next pint or whatever it is. You know, you're going to come to my pub again. Do you know what I mean? It's like that. You're constantly making sure that you're going to be hired again, because there's no long-term contract. There's a contract for that one ride and that's it. And it's over after that. And it's up to them. And there's 20 or 30 other people behind you that want that same job, you know? So it can be hard to work out what's best for the horse, but also what's best for the trainer and the owner. Do you know what I mean? So sometimes you could, you know, be telling them what they want to hear, or sometimes you want to be honest. And it was working out what do they want from this. You know, you're constantly trying to think, and that's hard for for a lot of the guys that are starting out at 16, 17, 18. I've not been given the tools yet of how to work that out. You know, so it takes you a while to kind of learn that process of, right, I'm not only making sure that I get a good result out of the horse, but I'll make sure, you know, I keep the ride on this thing and go forward, you know.
It's an incredibly complex process ultimately, isn't it? You know, you're not just turning up, jumping on a horse, riding it around in circles and going home. There are many facets, and all those facets are different, and there are spinning wheels and all the analogies in the world you can think of where there are multiples. And all the while you're thinking, I guess I need to stay safe. I need to keep the horse safe. Oh, and I need to please them. I've got to make sure they're all right. Oh, but I also need to make sure I get another ride tomorrow or later in the day, maybe in many cases. So there's so many things going on in the jockey's mind
while you're fighting your own weight as well, you know, so you're fighting, constantly fighting the scales, you know, so you throw that into it, fighting the scales, you know, constantly on the limit of like what I can eat and can't eat or drink, you know, in the saunas and, you know, running in sweatsuits and all sorts of stuff. So yeah, there's that side of it. So you're starving your body as well as your brain, and trying to keep everybody up. I remember, you know, later on in my life when I've left racing, I remember having a little bit of a heated discussion with one of the journalists saying, you know, why are jockeys so miserable? You know, they're always hard work. And I think he was being general in that, because they're not all miserable. They're not all hard work. But I think he'd obviously had a bad experience. And I said to him, I think what you've got to try and understand is, you know, what are you like when you're hungry? You know, do you get moody? And he was like, well, yeah, of course I do. I said, well, imagine waking up like that every day of your life. Like it is a draw on you for a while, you know? Mm. So just try and have a different perspective of what it's like for them. Do you know what I mean? And some empathy, you know, because I think if you do have that, I think then you'll have a better result of going forward, you know, working with them, you know, as a journalist.
I think, yeah, my family have always said I would have made an incredible jockey, but I just don't like waking up hungry every morning. So that's probably why I never made it in that field.
I often think the same, Simon.
You mentioned a really, really, really key word there, one which I know is important to you. It's really important to me, empathy. And it's kind of lost in elite sport in many, many ways across the piece. What level of support did you have as a sole trader, essentially, as an individual who's got all these people to please, who doesn't know necessarily where their next ride or paycheck is coming from, and has to manage everything else in terms of well-being and looking after that person, which is what we're all about as well. What support did you have in that time as a jockey?
Well, I, you know, we talk about mental health now as a, you know, the term mental health now, you know, is something that, you know, is in the discussion, thankfully. But at the time, you know, when you're having a rough day, because mental health isn't just you having a rough day, it's completely something else. Mm. But when you were having just a rough day, which I thought was, you know, just the normal, because I thought everybody else was in the same boat as me, because, you know, you talk amongst yourselves in the changing rooms. But those lonely drive homes, there was one person was my dad, you know, but, you know, he could only see it from his perspective of being a jockey himself anyway. So it was a bit like, you know, just keep trying that, you know, keep your head down. That was the thing. Mm. Keep your head down, keep working. It'll come good in the end. Do you know what I mean? Which is great.
It's what we do.
What tools can I have from that? You know what I mean? How do I get there? You know, that's the thing. I'm searching for something. Now that's just him giving me some support and doing what probably someone did to him. Now there's other jockeys in the changing rooms that would support, you know. I was always intrigued by how other riders were successful, and I was a big fan of other jockeys and the aesthetic of other jockeys, you know, your Franco Di Torres or the Richard Dunwoodies of the time, and Adrian Maguires and Steve Cawthons, and all these names that I'm mentioning were all like successful for a reason. And I was always intrigued, like, what made them good, you know, and they were all great communicators. But I think they also were great at passing down, you know, information or giving you some support as well, you know. So, you know, how did they communicate with owners? You know, how did they ride a certain race? How did they ride certain horses? Do you know what I mean? So I would constantly ask questions, and all the guys were very, very open. But one thing you would never talk about was, you know, if you were at rock bottom and not feeling great, it would be, you know, there's a constant, echo of, God, jockeys, they are tough sportsmen. Not only do they starve themselves, if they're injured, they'll get back as soon as possible, like other sports people, and they'll get back and ride. Well, of course they will. They've got no other choice. You know, it's not like they're contracted, you know, for like to a football team or, you know, to a racing team or whatever it may be, you know, and financially they've got the support there. They've got no, if they don't ride, they don't get paid. So yeah, of course so it was a double-edged sword, really. Yes, we look like we're tough athletes because we're getting back to getting ride soon. But, well, we had to, because if you don't ride, you don't get paid. And that made it hard, I think. That was the, you know, the real difficult thing. But no, if you were feeling like the pressures of that, wasn't really anywhere to kind of turn to. So thankfully there's things in place now, for our younger riders, to educate them, to be better at that and hopefully give them the tools to deal with those sort of pressures.
You mentioned it a couple of times there, the tools and the toolbox to fill up as well is sadly a relatively new concept, but again, as you say, one that one that is very much part of the conversation now, and I know you're a massive advocate of that as well within the equine world, but also just generally. Were there any particularly rough times, any times where you kind of were at your lowest point and just maybe didn't have those tools or necessarily that support network to support you?
Well, there was many times when, especially when I was a jockey, there was many times I was like that. And I remember constantly having this like kind of chip on my shoulder. I was angry about something, you know, because sometimes I would be frustrated, not only with myself, but with like the situation I was in. And I'm sure millions of people are like that. You know, it's like, there's that, what is niggling me? Why do I get so frustrated with myself if things can't kind of go in my way? Now, I wasn't one for, you know, blaming everybody else for it. I kind of blame myself for it. You know, like, I wasn't working hard enough. I wasn't trying hard enough. I needed to be better and all that sort of stuff. So that was one thing that I was constantly feeling. But my struggle with, you know, with mental health really came later on in life, really. You know, it was after kind of, you know, going to therapy and digging up some stuff that happened, you know, in my childhood, that really kind of, that was the main thing really that kind of, that got me to the point of where I didn't want to, you know, be around anymore. So it wasn't necessarily, even though I'm an advocate for help raising awareness in mental health in sports people, in particularly jockeys, because of the lifestyle that they have to lead. It wasn't really that got me to the place where I was really at rock bottom. It was part of that, but it was also other things that where I'd been to, you know, gone through a divorce, you know, a horse that I'd been a part of, you know, journey, he'd lost his life. Life wasn't really looking all that rosy for me. And at that point I'd had hit rock bottom. And then I was, you know, I needed to, you know, make a decision. What was I going to do about it? And for me at that time, I kind of took the easy way out and, you know, and attempted, you know, to take, you know, take my own life. Thankfully, I failed and I survived. You know, I'm a suicide survivor. That's like kind of what I call myself, really. So, once I got over the guilt of doing it, and enjoying my, journey back to consciousness, really, and being awake, really, for the first time. If anything, it was kind of made me wake up to, you know, the things that I kind of taken for granted in life, really, you know, because we've got one of them, you know, we need to live it for the best we can. Once I got beyond that, that's when I could really kind of like process what I'd been through to get me beyond that stage, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. Absolutely. And I mean, thank you for sharing that for starters, but it is an interesting conversation all around, isn't it? That once we start asking questions and we start being curious about some of the things that confuse us, which you did, going to therapy, talking about those traumas, divorce, childhood as well, you know, it doesn't unravel, and it kind of lets us know there's stuff going on and it's reasons for our behaviors that we don't necessarily understand. And it can be really scary and it can be really, really destabilizing. It can really turn us into dark points. And just to reiterate what you said, that fortunately you failed, because I'm glad you failed as well, as many, 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 many others are as well. It's not often we say that about our pals, but in this instance, that strength then that you've shown to come back round, to go, right, okay, I thought that was the way out. Actually, it turns out there is a different way. And I know you talk about it's kind of a, you're an advocate in life of support and mental health and telling stories and storytelling. And I'm keen to get into that a little bit more now as well. But just behind you, for those that are watching this, there are two posters. We're going to talk about one in a bit more detail shortly, but you can just make out the two L's on one of them. It's a brilliant short film that you made called The Fall, which is ultimately centered around the equine world, jockeys and kind of looking after mental health. Can you just tell us about that, first of all? What's the film about? And then what was your motivation, particularly in telling that story?
Well, one of the main motivations of it was, waking up on my kitchen floor after my suicide attempt. There was a lot of things kind of went through my head, what have I just done? My dad's going to kill me. Was one of the things that kind of go through your head. Why you think that? I don't know. And then I tried to process like why I did this, how have I got so low? And how would I have been so low for so long? And me having the work ethic that I've got, why had I let this get to this stage? And that's what I'm saying. It's like, mental health is an illness. It's not just me feeling down at the time and thinking, oh yeah, this is an easy way out. It wasn't that. It was like a whole process of me getting to that at that point, because it's not like that was my first, thought about it. I'd had many thoughts about it, and I'd even like spoke to other people about it. And one of the people I'd already spoke to about it was a guy called James Banks. Unfortunately, poor James didn't survive his suicide attempt. So once I got through this guilt and this process of, and I'm still getting through it, I haven't got through it. I work hard at it every day, and I think I kind of pin my cure for myself is helping other people process this stuff. So that's the reason why, the film was such an important thing. But through my process, and not long after James had took his life, I needed to do something. Like I needed to have a goal. And I had this story in my head that I needed to get out. And I remember laying, in the bed one day, and I'm not a writer, I mentioned earlier, I'm massively dyslexic. So I struggle just to write an email is hard for me. I've all the little tools you can think of to try and help me write it, just even write an email. So to write a story was hard, but I had this story in my head that I needed to get out of me. And I just started writing this story about the journey home. From somebody having a bad day at the office, whether it's a jockey having a bad fall, or a footballer not scoring a penalty, or somebody working in an office having a bad day, whatever that was, it was that journey home and this process that they're going through, of feeling like they don't need to be here anymore, because there was certain things going on in their life anyway that had gotten to this stage. What I wanted to also add in there, in this world that we're living in right now, is there's a lot of, we're very quick to kind of criticize people, and it's very easy to criticize people through social media or through text messages, because we kind of can be faceless. And a lot of jockeys had shown me, and I'd seen it on social media, but also the jockeys have shown me the messages, some of the messages that they were getting. Because they'd been beaten on a horse and somebody had had some money on it, or whatever the excuse was for this person to send these types of messages. So I wanted to kind of put the two together, show that the life of a jockey is extremely hard, like it is for lots of other people. And we're all very lucky to be in this industry, because we're sports people and we're getting paid to do the things we love. But I just want to show the outside world, like what the reality of being a professional jockey looks like. And then add in the social media, hate, basically, that happens, but also the text messages that these guys get. So that was the process. That was the idea. But I needed help to kind of get there, and me working, setting up Equine Productions as a content creator. That was my piece of work to put out to the world and basically go, here you go. This is me opening up. And I did it through a film rather than writing a letter or sculpting something. That was my sculpture in some way. That was my my process of dealing with what I've just gone through. So that was the key thing. But also the main thing was to try and hopefully wake people up to the reality of what jockeys are going through.
I'm interested to know, because you've mentioned the dyslexia piece a couple of times. Did this... We've spoken to a few other elite athletes, of which you are a former elite athlete as a professional jockey. It's as simple as that. And they've said that the dyslexia has actually helped in many ways in finding that slightly different way of approaching things. Now, whether it's in that field of play or off it, or how they tell a story, they found it really empowering, actually. And it's been a bit more of a superpower than it's been more of a hindrance or something that stopped them from doing something. Did you find that in this process at all? Did you find that you were able to be a bit more creative, or did that, have you ever explored that? I'm just really interested to kind of understand a bit more.
Well, yeah, and it's a bit like the mental health thing. It's a diagnosis of like who you are, because, you know, if I'd have known this when I was a kid, I'd have been able to do something about it, or at least I'd had the knowledge of what it is. Do you know what I mean? At the time, I just thought I was thick. Do you know what I mean? I was slow. I wasn't very good at stuff. Do you know what I mean? I was just, you know, and that's the reason why I wasn't very good at school. You know, I was talking about it to my wife the other day, my stepdaughter. She's a straight A student. And my wife said, do you have any A's? And I was like, I never even had a C. I was, you know, I'd have been over the moon if I'd have got a C. You know what I mean? It was like, I was just terrible at school. It just didn't work for me. Do you know what I mean? And I've now I can understand why. So I mentioned earlier, you know, I've got all the different types of apps, applications to help me do my job now, because I know about it now, and I'm not frightened of like admitting it, you know, and I'm not using it as an excuse. If I spell something wrong, I'll just go, oh yeah, that's fine. I'm not embarrassed about it. A bit like I'm not embarrassed about my, you know, my struggle with mental health, you know? So, I think, you know, it definitely did help me have a understanding of telling this story, because I was looking at it from a different process. Now then, the writing the script bit, that was the bit that was hard, which is when I, you know, reached out to Robert Bathurst, you know, who used to be in Cold Feet. He was a big horse racing fan, and I only reached out to him actually just to be in it, really. I wanted him to be in the movie. And, but he said, look, you know, I can kind of help you with this script. I can kind of help you get to where you've explained it to me differently to how it's on the page. And that has always been my trouble. It's like, I know what it looks like in my head, but I can't get it out of me onto the page. So how do I do that? And then he helped me get there. So yeah, exactly. So it was, that was a big help, having Robert helped me create the script, and then helped us get it funded, and then helped us get it made, really. And I think that, like you say, going back to your question, is, you know, has dyslexia been a help? I always see anything like that as a help, because it's just, you're just looking at a different, it's the perspective that you're looking at it from, and it's not a hindrance. It's just, you're just looking at it differently. That's all.
Oh, brilliant. I get that totally. I find, for anyone listening who hasn't seen The Fall yet, we'll share the links and we'll share it in the notes of the podcast, and make sure people can get access to it. Because for someone like me, who, I love sport, I'm into sport, all different types of sport, I'm not massively into the equine world, although certainly after we've connected over the last few years and mutual friends, I'm a lot more into it now. It works. As a message that you were trying to convey to the layperson, never mind jockeys, never mind people in the horse racing industry, it works. It's just the isolation of losing, the isolation of them being in the back of a car after a hard day's work, and the bright lights and the dings and the negativity that's there, all for trying to do your job. I think how you conveyed it is an astonishingly powerful piece, and definitely something people should watch, and hopefully those that have been guilty of using an excuse, to use a word that you've used there, you know, an excuse that they've lost a few quid, should definitely think about the impact of those messages in the future. So thank you for finding that ability to bring it from your brain and then putting it into the process. It's a brilliant piece.
No, thank you, Sam. No, I appreciate it. I mean, you know, if anything, you know, what was great about it after it had its release was the amount of people that came back to me saying, I know what to look out for now. You know, a clerk of the course from Chepstow had reached out to one of our good friends, Dave James, who's actually, you know, the CEO of Equine Productions, who I'm a business partner with, had reached out to him saying, I'm going to be looking for those signs now. You know, I'm going to be looking at jockeys differently, thinking, right, okay, it's a different perspective. And that's what we just said about that, about dyslexia. You know, it's about the perspective, really, of how you're looking at something. And I think that was the nicest thing out of it. And also a lot of jockeys reached out to me saying, you know, thank you for putting on the screen how I've been feeling or what actually it really looks like. You know, for some of those, you know, it's not like that for everybody, but it's like that for, you know, for most of them, I think. And like I say, if anything, it could be about any sports person having a bad day, a bad result, and then driving home. You know, it's the journey, really. And so I appreciate that it did so well.
You've got the empathy piece there with the jockeys that are in that position, and you've also then got the awareness piece for everybody else. So it hits both marks there massively. Talk to us about, we've talked a lot about isolation and being on your own, but just talk to us about some of the characters that you've come up and met and been involved with, worked with, trained with, ridden for. There's a lot of powerful people there. I know some are close to your heart, but just there are one or two names there that jump out at you for whatever reason.
Well, you know, working in this industry, you meet lots of successful people, whether it's in the industry or because they're the fan of the industry. So I've been, you know, I've been very, very lucky to meet, you know, a lot of great people. But, you know, there's a couple that kind of really stand out. You know, one of them is, you know, looking over my shoulder, there's a horse there called Many Clouds that won the 2015 Grand National. And, I remember, his trainer, Oliver Sherwood, has been a real, real big part of my life. And in fact, big part of my, journey and my, recovery, really. Because, you know, right. he was a real support when I was having a bit of a rough time, really, you know, just making sure I was all right. And, you know, and if anything, he was, you know, it was good to see him have success with that horse. Cause it's a bit like, you know, all the great stories of all, you know, great people are, you know, they do well, and all of a sudden they fall off a cliff, don't do well, but then it's the comeback. That's the comeback story of you know, that everyone loves, don't they? You know, especially us as storytellers, we love that. And Oliver kind of definitely been part of that. You know, so he's done really, you know, had a lot of success in the 80s as a successful trainer, then kind of, you know, fell away for a while, you know, in late 90s, early 2000s, and then came back with, you know, with Many Clouds and a couple of others, Puffin Billy, and you know, some good horses that kind of put him back on the map again. But you know, it's funny, like, how we kind of measure success. You know, some people measure it with, you know, big houses, cars, and all that sort of stuff. But what I saw in Oliver is how he measures success is like the people around him. Do you know what I mean? And he always had great people around him and his team. Yeah. And he was, no matter who was working for him or who was he trained for, he always had time for people. And that was one of the main things that I loved about working with Oliver. He was just, you know, and sometimes he wasn't in great form, you know, he knew to kind of avoid him if he was in a having a bad day, like all of us can do. But, you know, it wouldn't take long because he could just tell he really appreciated the position he was in. And I think that's what I got from working with Oliver for so long, as was being around him for that length of time. And then, you know, him then succeeding, winning one of the biggest races, the horse races in the world, you know, and the joy of him getting, you know, all that success from that as well, you see. And unfortunately, he's not training anymore. You know, he's retired. He retired last year. But I know he still has the hunger for, you know, finding a young horse, bringing it on. And then that young horse then goes and does well. You know, I see it in my wife when she's got, you know, she teaches, you know, 6-7-year-old kids, you know, and she's still now, you know, it the joy she gets out of teaching somebody something, then taking it on and going forward. I get it now. I understand that journey of, like, you know, one of my favorite quotes is, the only time you should look down on somebody is when you're helping them up. Do you know what I mean? That's the only time you should look down on somebody, you know? And I think, yes, give everybody a leg up, you know, And that's one thing Oliver really, really stood for. I love that. I love that in him.
Yeah, that is fantastic. I'm going to mention two words. You mentioned them already. And I'm going to mention the kind of sad bit about it, but I only say that to get out of the way so you can do the celebrating, because I know how important this is. There's a horse behind you in the other poster, Many Clouds. You've mentioned this particular horse a couple of times already. I've said already, I'm not in the equine world, horse racing world. It's not my thing. I've never really been an animal person. I've never really got it. You've talked about connection and understanding that as a 16-year-old, you have this connection with these animals. And sadly, I remember watching you being interviewed at the end of January 2017 when, very, very sadly, Clouds had a fall in a race and passed away. And I vividly remember watching you on the telly just inconsolable. And I think for me, that was the moment where I kind of went, oh, right, okay, I'll get it now. I get it. And I only kind of say that mainly because I do remember how vivid it was and how much of an impact it had on me for someone that's not in it. For someone like you, who had the opportunity, built this relationship, just tell us about that horse. Tell us about the Grand National. Tell us about everything, because I know how much of a smile and how much joy Clouds brought you as well, and how much you were involved in his success.
Well, it's funny, you know, you're calling him Clouds. You know, it's funny how he has his, yeah, like, that's exactly his character's, yeah, name. You know, his name was Many Clouds, yeah, but, you know, everyone calls him Cloud. You know, so he had a personality, you know, which the poster behind me, you know, Many Clouds, the film's called The Many Clouds, The People's Horse. And, he wanted to tell his story, unfortunately, when he passed. And, but to get to that point, you know, he'd been a huge impact on my life, really, because I went through quite a painful divorce in 2015, not long after we'd won the Grand National. And, it was like, and I was already struggling with stuff anyway. But he kind of helped me through all that. Do you know what I mean? You know, hit me making sure that I was going in every morning to ride him out, or being part of his life and his success and all that sort of stuff was a reason to get up in the morning. You know, that's what I would say. You know, he was like one of my best mates. You know, I'd love to, you know, it'd be great to go and have a pint with. Do you know what I mean? I know some people are like, what are you on about? It's a horse. But, you know, anybody that's an animal lover and knows exactly what I'm talking about, you know, even, you know, from their dog to their cat to their budgerigard, you know, they all have personalities and they all have a way of communicating with you. And he had a great way of communicating. You know, he was just a gentle giant, really, and gave all, you know, like Oliver mentioned, you know, he'd run through a brick wall for you. You know, you would take him to war. You know, he was one of those type of characters, you know, would never give in. Unfortunately, it came to his demise. You know, that was, one thing that kind of caught up with him, but I think he kind of like went out doing what he loved. Do you know what I mean? Horses can't talk and animals can't talk, but I know for fact, you know, that he loved doing what he was doing. You know, every time we went out to go and get him in from the field, he'd be there waiting. He wanted to come in because he knew he was going out training the next day. Do you know what I mean? So I understood that in him. You know, not all horses like that, but he was definitely like that. But he definitely connected with his, you know, work ethic, his the way he jumped, you know, fences, the way he ran and never give in, you know, people could kind of connect with that, you know, because we see that in other sporting arenas and we see that in other people. You know, if someone's, you know, the underdog that's just trying to do their best, they might not have all the class in the world, but they've definitely got all the heart and the work ethic to get through that. We can connect with that in some way. And that's one thing that he had. And a lot of people kind of really, really, really enjoyed watching him do what he did. And when we, unfortunately, when he passed and we made this film and we aired it in New York at the Equus Film Festival. And I remember two guys from Texas that were there, and they were like, They'd never even heard of the Grand National, but they were like, we want to go and watch this race because of the, you know, watching the film. And, but what an amazing horse he was, and what a journey you've had with him. And I'm like, absolutely. Cause, you know, I'm now talking to you on a podcast in California, because of him, because, you know, when we first started Jockey Cam, he was part of that journey. You know, the first time we used it, you know, on live television was at the 2015 Grand National. He won with that, you know, with the camera on him. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, if that hadn't happened, I'm not sure we'd be where we are today. Do you know what I mean? So I owe all my success really to, you know, to him being part of it, you know? So, you know, it's been great that he was part of that journey, the Jockey Cam journey. And now, like I say, I'm here in the US, you know, trying to create something and succeed in what we're doing. And he's definitely been part of that journey.
Oh, mate, look, you know, he'd be very, very proud. I know Oliver Sherwood is as well. And he'd speak just as glowingly about you and your role as you have about him. So really, really grateful for that. Just tell us a little bit about, you've mentioned Equine Productions, the storytelling piece. You've mentioned Jockey Cam there. Just give us a flavour. What are they? How do they come about? And what does this future look like now in the equine world for you?
Well, but, you know, when you asked me earlier, you know, when we first started the chat, you said, you know, what got you into the sport? And I told you about the Arazi story. Before then, like I said, I wasn't kind of coming to this sport because I felt as though it kind of didn't, this sport didn't speak to me. It didn't attract me in any way. So I've always been intrigued by that. Like, how do I find the kid that's not intrigued by it now? How do I, what's the hook? What, you know, what's my Arazi? That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
So, you know, so whether it's through making a documentary series like we did, a couple of years ago, Horsepower, which is, you know, on Amazon Prime, a 4-part documentary series telling the story of a trainer and the inner workings and the characters and the people that, you know, they're in the sport and why we do what we do, whether it's that or whether it's a, you know, a camera angle that shows the live, you know, angle of what the jockey sees in, you know, for broadcast, or whether it's the our VR experience that we've created where kids can and the public can wear this VR experience and experience what it's really like to ride in a race. Whatever tools there are, I'm going to use them to be my Arazi moment. That's the key, really. And that's why Equine Productions was created. You know, we created it in 2012 because Dave James, who's a good mate of yours, one of your best mates and my business partner, and Sam Fleet, who's my other business partner, that the three of us wanted to create something that was going to, you know, kind of reach out beyond the core racing audience to engage and inspire people to kind of just take a look at our sport. We are different. But once you're in it, it's so addictive, and that's what we want to try and do. Really, is create something that reaches out beyond that audience and that core audience, and helps us understand more and engage with us, you know, and become a fan. Because I think, like all sports, you know, we've seen it with Formula One. It was on a downward spiral. If it wasn't for the Drive to Survive series, it wouldn't be the big powerhouse that it is now. You know, they've added, you know, what, 3 or 4 more race meetings to their season now. All because of this Drive to Survive series. You know, I was sat in a restaurant a couple of months ago. Behind me were 4 18 to 22 year old girls all talking about who their favorite driver was. Wow. I mean, you know, that would never have happened, right? You know, so whatever tools there is, then that's what we're trying to do with Equine Productions, really, is create content where that people can understand the participants and the characters in the sport and help have an understanding and fall in love with the characters. We've seen that with, you know, with the great series Welcome to Wrexham. You know, there were, you know, a team, you know, in the 50th of the league, and, you know, everyone's falling in love with all those characters. I mean, look at the fan base that they've created. So storytelling, sport creates, you know, great stories, and it's just how do we tell those stories? And that's why Equine Productions was mainly picked up, really. And, you know, like I say, whether it's storytelling or it's a point of view or it's an experience, I'm going to use any tool the tools I can to help gain more fans.
you're definitely doing that between you and your colleagues, Equine Productions, Jockey Cam. I think it's such a brilliant way to look at it as well. I haven't kind of thought about it that way, that your Arazi moment, you never know, could well be similar to the next Nathan Horrocks's Clouds, Many Clouds moment, Jockey Cam, first time. There may be a kid out there that saw that 9 years ago and went, right, that's going to get me into this industry and that world. I mean, it'd be so lovely and amazing to one day hopefully hear that's the case, but you're doing everything that you've set out to do, and long may that continue.
Well, it's a bit like, you know, what you're doing with, with the Speakeasy Club, Simon. You want to give back in some way. Although, you know, we need to be financially able to, you know, to live and work and look after our families. But if you can go out to work, you know, the job that you do and enjoy it and feel as though you're giving back to something, that's kind of my drive. Not everybody's like that. Not everybody can be like that. I understand that there's different things in life. But, that like what you're doing with the Speakeasy Club, you're creating something that's also, not only is it satisfactory for you personally, but you're helping other people find a pathway to a better journey in life, I feel. And I think that's what it's all about, you know. There's nothing better than actually making someone feel good about themselves, right? You know, that's
absolutely
the key.
Right. Yeah.
You know, bringing someone a bit of joy. I mean, it's the best feeling in the world. It beats any drug in the world. It is, you know, having some joy out of something you created, I think, is the best feeling in the world. And I think everybody should really try and search for that somewhere in life. And that's definitely something I've taken on board in my second part of my life, you know, which has been, you know, really fruitful, thankfully.
Yeah. Oh, listen, I totally agree. And I think we could talk about that for hours. I think it's one of the many things that connects us and why I really wanted to have a chat with you and sit down on this podcast. And I've learned a lot more than I thought. Not that I thought I was going to do. That's maybe not fair. I learned more about stuff I didn't know about, if that makes sense. There's more little nuggets behind each story that perhaps I haven't picked up. But Nathan Horrocks, the name of this podcast, in closing, is Where's Your Clubhouse? We talked a little bit before the start. We started recording, and in this series, we've talked to quite a few different people, all involved in the sports world in one way, shape, or form. And when you ask the question, or you ask yourself, "Where's your clubhouse?" it's not necessarily something you've thought about. And for me, it's my local rugby club. That's the place I feel safe and not judged, and I can just go and be the kind of best version of me. We've had so many different interpretations, but I love asking the question. So I'm going to ask you, Nathan Horrocks, where is your clubhouse?
Well, it used to be the George in Lambourne. It used to be the George in Lambourne, because I'd meet up with my good mate Nick Bentley, Josh Appiaffe, a guy called Chris Newstead, you know, and we'd all have a pint and chat about, you know, life and the struggles, and sometimes if one of us was down, the other one lift us up and all that. Unfortunately, you know, I don't live there anymore, and so my clubhouse has turned into a WhatsApp group now. And what's lovely about that little WhatsApp group is that we can share, you know, stories. We can share things that make us laugh, you know, frustrations or whatever that may be. But our little WhatsApp group, and I'm sure most men I've spoken to of my age have got a WhatsApp group with a load of mates, and that's what's fantastic. But our WhatsApp group is called Bad Boys for Life, and the story behind the Bad Boys for Life bit is the movie Bad Boys, where Martin Lawrence's daughter is his character's daughter's going out, and Reggie knocks on the door, and Martin Lawrence and Will Smith's characters answer the door, and poor Reggie's frightened to death because he's going to be taking the daughter out. And all of us are in this WhatsApp group, all found that absolutely hilarious, that because one of the WhatsApp group attendees, his daughter was of that age. And that's where the essence of the WhatsApp group started.
Oh, but
it's been my clubhouse for many years, you know, since that movie came out. And, what we've always doing is we're always supporting each other, if someone's got a gripe or if someone's got an issue or if someone's just, you know, just a bit down or whatever, you know, we reach out to each other. How's everybody doing? How are we all doing? And we do get to meet up every now and again, and whether it be a golf day or whatever it may be, or if I go back to Cheltenham, you know, to England to Cheltenham races or whatever it may be, you know, we meet up again. But I think your clubhouse is, like you just said there, Simon, is your safe space. You know, when you go to your local rugby club, there's nothing off the table. You feel free. You feel open. No. And I think that's what's lovely about your clubhouse. I mean, you know, you tell me, you know, what does that look like for you when you're at your clubhouse? You know, are they always the same characters, or have you pulled in different characters that have come into that wouldn't normally be in your clubhouse? How's that been for you?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. I mean, you kind of have that familiarity. You have the same people behind the bar, and you have the same people more often than not will be in there at the same times of day. So you feel like you'll know some of the faces in there, which is nice. I think, funny enough, as you know, I've got a young son called Reggie as well, and I'd love it if his first date he was met at the door by Martin Lawrence and Will Smith. I think that'd be hilarious. He feels safe. He goes in there and people know him and he's welcome, and he can take himself off and look at, you know, he's safe in there. But people look after each other, and ultimately that's kind of all you want from life, isn't it, really? If you have to go into an enclosed space, or physically or metaphorically in your case with the WhatsApp group, you used a brilliant phrase before we started recording, you know, you feel really connected to that group whilst also disconnected, because it's a kind of a technology thing, but then also reconnected because, you know, that is your mobile clubhouse, if you will, which is a really strong and powerful thing. So I think for me, it's like-mindedness, it's familiarity, and it's that empathy and understanding to be whoever you want to be. And there's no judgment with that.
Well, I think that's key. I think, Simon, and you know, you mentioned it twice now, is the judge thing, because none of us like to be judged, do we? You know, we're all human beings. We all want to be liked. We all want to be loved. And if we feel any judgment, that then kind of helps. Well, that helps the alienation kind of take over, really. But none of us want to feel alienated, do we? You know. So I think, if anything, that safe space and that non-judgmental space that you're in is a great place to be in, because, like I say, you can be more open then. And I think that's what the key thing is I've noticed over the last kind of 20 years, probably last 10 years, I should say. But, you know, men in particularly, you know, working class men, they're becoming more open. They've been given permission to be more open, and it's not a case of, you know, it's a fad or it's something that's happening. It's a case of it's a space to be in, and we're all talking about either mental health issues or you know, struggles with certain things or whatever it may be. But having that space of not being judged, I think, is key to everything, really. And in particular, you know, working class men, I think that it's been a big help for us to kind of communicate better, which I've enjoyed seeing that process happen. And I, obviously I want that to get better, you know, moving forward.
Absolutely. Would I like that. Would you say there's two parts to that? One. Which way we're doing it. In the first instance, yeah, you're right. There's permission to do it now more than ever before. But then the second part perhaps is giving ourselves or those men giving themselves permission to be able to do it. It's all very well, the outside world going, no, it's all right to talk now. It's all right to be okay and talk about how you're feeling and not be happy all the time. But everything starts with you, doesn't it? So them then being comfortable enough to go, right, the environment's there. Now I'm ready to go into that environment as well, because it's got to be a two-phase thing, isn't it?
Oh, I think so. It's the feel of not being threatened, I think, you know, because that's, you know, we're meant to be tough. We're meant to be, that is being tough. If you're talking about, like, you know what, I've had a really crap day today, it's been hard. I'm feeling like at my lowest. For me, I think that is brave when you can. But I just need somebody to listen to me right now. I need to kind of get this off my chest. And if there's any advice, or there's no advice, it's just a welcoming ear. You know, someone just to listen to me. Mm-hmm. You know, and help me have a different perspective. You know, it happens all the time. You know, if someone's, you know, really down and they're in that kind of in that mental state of like, you know, I'm really struggling here. They can't see the bigger picture. They're looking at the world with a really small lens. And I'm going to use my film, you know, background here. And, you know, we want to open that up. We want to put a wider lens on it and let them look at, like see the horizon more, see a clear horizon. That's what we're all after, right? You know, is a clear horizon, you know, no obstacles, and help people like, understand that those obstacles are all right if they're there. We'll get past them. They're just obstacles. We'll get over them, under them, around them. But to do that, we need to all work together and share our issues those things will definitely, you know, advice or therapy tools, whatever it is, you know, working out a walk, you know, as I learned on a recent, a symposium where I did a mental health talk. A couple of jockeys use ice baths as a way of helping their mental health. Jumping in an ice bath because you've got to concentrate on your breathing, right? And they say, and when they get out of those, they feel so mentally like kind of like strong after doing that. You know, I'm like, right, well, there's another tool I can add to my list. You know, so what are those things that we can share to help each other be better in our journey going forward? I think that's the key. And you know, whether it's your clubhouse or a podcast or a beer, sharing each other's stories and helping each other along in life, I think is a way forward.
Ultimately, I think you've just summarized there what you've said all the way through this conversation is just see things from a different perspective. And I couldn't be any more perfect. Nathan, mate, thank you so much for taking the time. I don't know if it's turned into afternoon now. I've kept you chatting so long where you are, but really appreciate it. It goes without saying, please keep doing what you're doing. Keep advocating, keep talking and creating those spaces, both in the equine and the day-to-day world. And just the very, very best of luck with Jockey Cam and everything coming forward. Thank you for your time, mate.
Appreciate giving you the time, Simon, and keep up the great work that you're doing as well. You know, like I say, if we keep sharing each other's stories, you know, it gives us all permission and empathy towards a different perspective, like we just said. So I appreciate you having me on, and thanks again.
Hey.
We really hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as we did. We certainly took a lot away from it, and it's important to us to hear your feedback. Let us know what you think. Please leave a review, leave us a rating, and it would mean an awful lot to us to hear your feedback. Please stick with us. We look forward to welcoming you soon back into the clubhouse. And it's really exciting, some of the guests we've got coming up for the rest of the series. So I'll leave you with one question. I'm sure you can guess what it is. And that one question is, where is your clubhouse? See you soon.